Hey, Jay. How's it going, buddy?
It's going pretty well, man. How are you doing?
I'm good. Folks, welcome to Actual Facts, a podcast about documentaries. My name's Eric.
Hi, I am Jason.
And this is a the partnership with Movie Maker Magazine. This podcast, we talk about documentary films. We interview documentary filmmakers. And Jay and I here, we have little conversations about these films. And today we are talking about American Pain. Technically came out in 2022. I think that's probably when it hit festivals. It's very recently showed up on Max. That's where you can currently watch it. And its director is Darren Foster, who we will be talking to in an interview later in this episode. Jay, would you give us the short summary of what this documentary is about?
Oh, no problem. I didn't know you were going to ask, but I did happen to prepare something. So, American Pain tells the story of the George brothers, Jeff and Chris, who were self-described pioneers of the high-volume pill mill game. They opened several extremely lucrative pain clinics in Florida, sold hundreds of millions of dollars worth of oxycodone pills to patients who flocked to their clinics from all across the country, and in doing so, they gave the American opioid crisis a boost that it desperately needed.
It desperately needed that boost, right?
It did. Things were just not progressing as quickly as we would have wanted up until the George boys got involved.
That's right. Yes. And the director, Darren Foster, he offers an incredibly compelling story here that exposes the tower of corruption that made the George's enterprise so massively successful, from the drug manufacturers to the investigators to the lack of other resources made available to any of their clients. So, you know, this really shows at this level that isn't explored in some of the other films and books that are out there about the crisis. You hear about the pharmaceutical companies to some degree, you hear about kind of like the street level operations, you read about addicts, but this is like a huge catalyst, like you said, for how this whole crisis evolved. And so really understanding the people and getting a good emblematic version of how the distribution at this level happened is really useful. Anyways, a great story. And he uses hundreds of hours of wiretap recordings, lots of undercover videos. And then he also has his own exclusive interviews with some of the key players, including George Brothers and some of their rivals in the Florida's pill mill boom. And yeah, it's a shocking film in a lot of ways, especially because of how much you get to see how these people's complete lack of remorse for the people that they're affecting, they just don't seem to care. They still don't seem to care, to be honest. Or at least the kind of main culprit, Chris George. I think that to some degree you could argue that guy, Derek Nolan, he seemed a little bit more reflective on what had happened retrospectively. At any rate, Jay, from you, what were your impressions about the documentary? What did you think?
Well, firstly, like, they seem like really cool guys. I think that that's
salt of the earth.
Like, I mean, kind of just cool vibe. Like, it seemed like great hangs. Like, my initial impressions, I mean, obviously it's just like shock and sadness. And I mean, you know, it's, there's so many aspects of the story that are unbelievable. And like you just touched on, the lack of remorse, sort of across the entire chain of people responsible for this thing is really, you know, disheartening. And that's a major takeaway. Another thing, like I said, is like about the, like these guys as characters. I mean, it's just amazing. Like what they were doing and sort of how seemingly kind of like organized and proactive and motivated they were, while at the same time, like, I mean, it's not fair or nice to say that they're just dipshits, but it's like, there's also like a level where they're just not thinking about like basic things. It's like a big part of the documentary is capturing, like you said, wiretaps of recordings of all their cell phone conversations that these guys had. They conducted all this business and had these conversations about sort of illegal and damning things just on their personal cell phones. And it's just like, have you ever seen any TV show in your entire life? Have you watched one episode of The Wire? Like, where like everybody, like for the last 50 years, like any program you've seen, like people, you know, get a burner phone. Like, I mean, I'm glad they didn't, because I'm glad that they were stopped and there were repercussions, but it's just, it's wild. But it does demonstrate, I think, like, how these guys were and were confident that they were, like, acting, like, sort of under, like, the guise of legality with this whole operation.
No, I think that's exactly what it does. It really points to how much they, there are aspects, or parts of those conversations, you do hear them kind of brush up on the idea that, like, I hope no one's listening to this, et cetera. But the brashness, the complete boldness of having these conversations the way that they did, does show that they did not think that they thought they were above the law, not even above the law, actually, because like you were saying, it's like they thought that they were operating closely enough within the letter of the law that they were just not ever going to be in trouble. I think that they knew that, clearly knew that they were operating in a moral swamp of, like they don't think that they thought that they were doing things that were okay to do, but I think that they didn't think that they were going to be in trouble for them. And it's crazy. I should say this happened like between 2008 and 2010. Yeah. And watching it, for the same reason that you just outlined, I was thinking, like, you know, maybe I'm just not remembering correctly, but did I have that many phone conversations, or back then was I texting, you know, like I am now? Like, everyone, the joke is that no one even wants to pick up the phone anymore and have a voice conversation. I certainly try to limit the amount of times I call someone without them knowing I'm going to call them. These guys did everything, you know, in their own voices on these phone calls where I recorded. And it just, so I was wondering, like, God, back then, did people do this more? I don't think they did, though. It is bizarre that they had so much of this business done in the way that they did, just on completely unprotected lines.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there is the Florida factor in all of this, where maybe, like, you know, they were, because I agree with you. I think by 2008, like, my phone calls had gone way, way down. And, you know, other than making important phone calls, I'm probably already texting everything by that point. But I will say this, like, one of the more shocking things that early on in this documentary that you find out about Florida, where all this happened, and it's fair to say that this massive pill mill, you know, system that they created couldn't have happened without the aid of Florida, like that unlike, I think, every other state in our country, like, Florida did not have, like, a database that tracked the prescriptions that people were, well, basically that tracked prescriptions and pill dispersal to people. So, like, whereas, like, here in California, if you go to a doctor and get, you know, a prescription for whatever pain medicine, you can't just go the same day to a different doctor and get another prescription. But in Florida, they did not have the database that would show you whether or not a patient had done that yet, which is just, like, that was just, you know, shocking to me that in 2008, 2009, they just didn't have that sort of infrastructure set up already. And it's like, wow, that's alarming. I don't know what that has to do with Florida. I don't know what that has to do with the politics down there, but it does seem like there's some, I'm sure that there were some people that had a definite interest in preventing that kind of tracking from happening, you know?
Yeah, I have mentioned to you that I read, there's a book also called American Pain. It is not related to this movie.
Mm.
It's just too good of a title. And it's about these guys also. And it does go into that a little bit more, where it says that there was a significant, I think there was, it was a sort of a campaign led by a woman, I think possibly a mother of someone who had died from an overdose, who was really trying to get that registry in Florida developed and launched, and had massive political resistance to it. Didn't happen for a long time. I think it's in place now, but years and years. So yeah, absolutely something where the way that the experience of just things were designed was a huge catalyst for how this all played out. Like, it wasn't coincidental that this happened in Florida, and it happened in Florida in large part because some of the laws that made it possible.
Yeah.
That is on full display here. So some reflections for me. I mean, like you said, you just could not have asked for more incredible, quote unquote, characters. Obviously, these are real people, but they are like cartoon characters, just their affinity for things like Affliction shirts and giant trucks and guns and fireworks and all this crazy shit that just is like, who the, suffice it to say that they are not a lot like me or you. I didn't relate to them on that level. That's, I guess, fair. There are people out there that do. The kind of intermingling of what they were doing with like strip club businesses and, just everything is like, these. Not surprising, I guess, but that those kinds of folks would be involved in this game. But it was, as from the perspective of watching it as a film, it was pretty satisfying to see both these guys acting so foolishly and brazenly, and then ultimately having to pay for that, what they were doing.
And I
was remarkable, of course, also just to build a little bit on what we were saying before, that just to see how little they actually see that what they were doing was wrong. I think because they believed that they were operating within the letter of the law, they somehow were just really had a failure to acknowledge. I think they saw it, but to acknowledge it at a deep level, their moral culpability for all this addiction and sickness and ultimately death as well. Like they even, as we've said, towards the end of the film, when some of the more current interviews have happened, they don't. They see themselves as just having, or at least Chris George sees himself as being a business person in the same way that any other business is someone who is started by someone who identifies a need in a market and then serves it. And that's it. Beyond that, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't really care about what the effects are.
Yeah. I mean, I think that like, it's interesting to think about because it does seem like Chris George's attitude, like definitely there's an interview with him at the end of the film, taking place in a more modern time frame where it seems like he's explaining exactly this and where you definitely see his lack of remorse even 15 years later, or almost 15 years later. And it is the basic attitude of like, well, it's just a business. And I think like there's an underlying thing of like, it's capitalism, baby. It's like, if we didn't do it, somebody else would have done it. And as disgusting as that is, it's like, he's not wrong,
right?
Because if the ability was there to exploit these loopholes or the structure that would allow for this to happen, all it takes is the person with the right sort of lack of morality and and obsession with wealth and to capitalize on that. It's all across, like every step of the way, it's people really leaning on like the technicality of things being done legally. Like I think that there's a guy in the documentary, I want to say his name is Lou Fisher. Is that right?
Yeah.
Where he's the guy that was basically like a sort of,
I couldn't believe he even decided to be in this movie. He looks so bad.
He looks so bad, but he also looks totally unflappable. And it's like that same thing of like, look, he's a guy that was kind of like, I guess an official, like a go-between, like between these clinics and between like the wholesaler selling the pills, that basically was just kind of reviewing like the operations and making sure everything from the medical side, like that the doctors, technically speaking, weren't doing anything illegal, and that the wholesalers, like it was okay for them technically to sell pills to these people. And so he was just basically working with both sides to just help these people like work within like the confines of what is legal. And you can just tell like from him talking, like he in no way thinks that like there's something wrong with what he did, or if there is, I mean, maybe he just doesn't want to like admit any kind of culpability, but it's like, but yeah, he just looks like a guy that's like, dude, like you really like helped facilitate this whole thing. And it's so gross, I guess, to just like, pretend like it's like, well, I was just doing my job. It's right. it's well, you weren't just doing your job. Like you were.
Yeah. There's a few people along the way in this movie that have, I think, play similar roles in the regard that you're talking about there, in terms of, like sort of portraying this idea that like, well, because we're doing it correctly, or we were, sort of like the presenting this masquerade of it being okay because we were doing it in the way that you told us we could do it. The mom of the George brothers, she works with them at the clinic at some point, and she says something in one of the conversations that are recorded, the phone conversations, about like, look, I think it's when there's a news story in which she is mentioned. It happens to mention her, and Chris calls her to tell her that she is mentioned, and she's kind of lets it roll off her back because she says, look, you know, this stuff's always been out there. Like, people always have been addicted to things, and, you know, she basically is like, you know, we're doing what we're doing, and that's not a problem. And one thing I asked Darren about in the interview that I didn't end up including, but I thought it was interesting, was, you know, were like Lou Fisher or the mom or anyone along the way, was there anyone that he talked to or anyone that he'd studied, and they're doing the research for this movie, that he felt really did convince themselves that what they were doing was okay, because what they were doing was no different than selling cigarettes or something else? And he said, you know, no, that they all did know it, that if you listen long enough, you can tell that they all know that they're doing great damage, and that just the fact that they're doing it, quote unquote, legally, none of them have actually fooled themselves, in his view, into thinking that that actually means that it's okay.
Like, when you think about the documentary, are there any like specific scenes that stick out, or anything about the film itself that stands out to you?
One thing that is not in the book, American Pain, which, again, no formal relationship to the film, but about the same subjects.
Do they talk to Darren Foster in that book at all, or?
No, I asked Darren about this, and it's totally, totally separate. I was a little surprised about that, actually, because it tells a lot of the same story, but there are aspects of it that go in different directions and go deeper and not as deep in some ways.
And he was deeply immersed in the scene down there. Yeah,
totally. I didn't realize that when we watched the film. It isn't really something that he mentions, but he had been, they do show that there were people with cameras in cars just kind of filming the outside of these clinics back in 2008, 2009, because they had just started popping up everywhere, and there were lines and lines and lines of people waiting to get in, and lots of stuff happening in the parking lot as a result that wasn't super awesome. And so people were just, you know, journalists were showing up, and people that were just interested. And I guess in his case, someone who was both interested and someone who thought potentially he might make a documentary or cover this subject in some way.
Did the George boys ever shoot at him with a slingshot?
He did mention. did we not talk about this?
No, we didn't talk about that.
Yeah, they chased him down. He is one of the people that was, I think he talks about this in the movie, but doesn't say that he was one of these people that this happened to, is that they saw them in the car filming them back in 2008, 2009, not even filming them, just filming the outside of the clinic to be like, what the hell is happening here? Like, why are there so many people showing up to this? And they saw them and ran out after them, got in a car, and they chased them. Like, they had a car chase where they chased them down. Cops had to be called. The cops broke him up, and I was as surprised as a result that he managed to kind of stay in contact with these guys over the years. And he said that was the first time that he met them, and it was in some ways the way that he got specifically interested in this, or not specifically interested in this, but specifically involved in telling this particular story, not just about pain clinics, but about George Brothers specifically. So that's wild.
Yeah, and I should say, I mean, that detail didn't come out of nowhere. That is one of the recurring kind of unintentionally hilarious things, is like one of their preferred weapons of choice, these guys. They like guns too, but they use slingshots and ball bearings and like shot them. It's like, well, these are like,
kids.
They're children. Yeah. Right. Just children. But anyway. So, I had asked, scenes?
Oh, yeah. So what I was saying is that there, you know, in the book, one person that I don't believe you hear from at all is that guy, Kurt McKenzie, who was really great on camera and also just like, you know, kind of a grounding presence. He's the FBI agent who had worked on the case. And it was kind of useful to see him, because he grounds the story quite a lot and gives perspective from law enforcement, but also really useful to see in light of some of the stuff we were talking about before, just about how, in a lot of ways, the laws in Florida enabled this into happening in the first place, to see how hamstrung he was throughout the investigation. Like, obviously, he's constantly kind of rolling his eyes and shaking his head at the lack of moral fortitude that these guys had. But, you know, you can tell that there's a lot about how long this took to crack and to bring them to justice, that he just felt completely like, man, this shit is fucked.
Yeah, that is that is very, very clear. Like with the FBI folks, it's like, it's an interesting thing because like you can tell it's like they are happy with what they accomplished, but then there's another side of it where they realize they just were sort of barely making a dent in a much larger thing and going after really, you know, obviously I think we discussed already is like this is a sort of chain of things that goes from these clinics to wholesalers to manufacturers and you know, and you get these drug companies like Purdue or whatever, where I, you know, nobody from Purdue, as far as I know, has been held personally accountable. I think they've had to finally pay some fines and things, but it's like the FBI is just like hamstrung, like what they can actually do and who they can actually go after. And so anyway, that's not, but yeah, I mean, there's some great, like I should say the film is like super, it's, you know, bleak in ways, but it's super entertaining. It's really like super, you know, fast paced and it's really like a triumph of editing. Like there's so many different bits of footage, like the handheld camera footage from some of the people like Darren. There's intercut with these excerpts from these phone calls with these interviews, and the thing is really like quickly paced and there's so much information crammed, I don't want to say crammed in, and I'm making it sound like a bad thing, but just like you get so much information and it moves so quickly that it's really like sort of an intense and engaging, you know, film to watch. It doesn't feel like a slog at all. Like it's really
definitely not.
It's and so I really, you know, enjoyed that aspect of it for sure. Like just
I mean, one thing I was saying to you is that there's a lot of movies, obviously a lot of documentaries that aren't streaming right now. One of the ways that they've gone is that like a story that really needs to be told in about 90 minutes gets broken down to like 7 episodes.
Yes.
One thing that I definitely am not always stoked with, because it's like I'd love to hear this story, but I don't necessarily want to commit to the entire. So that's, it's great from that perspective. Like it really is tight in terms of filmmaking. The other way that a lot of films, documentary films on streaming that have been created over the last couple of years seem to be going is like what I described to you is looking like a glorified version of a 48 hours episode.
Right.
I mean, that's probably even too good of a description for it, because 48 hours episodes would have required a lot of journalists doing a lot of research. And not that there isn't work that goes into a lot of these movies, but they sort of like there's this approach where you find a subject that's out there in the ether that people are interested in. Maybe there's like one or two really great reported features already out there that you can draw from. And then you just kind of get a lot of the subjects together to over the course of a few days and interview them on the same set and build the movie out of that. And you can get a lot of stuff out of that too, but this is not that kind of movie. It is like, it's very much a tier above that. It is a totally different type of documentary, the kind that you would imagine seeing, you know, 20 years ago about something, the kind that you would imagine being screened at festivals or in theaters. It is, it's a great film. So I do recommend it. And it's like you said, super entertaining on top of it, even though it does deal with very bleak subject matter.
Yeah, I 100% agree. It's super, I mean, it's really great and really well-made film. And yeah, definitely recommend anybody watch it. I mean, there's so much to absorb. There's so many characters, even like sort of like, you know, ancillary characters, I guess, like the different people that were involved in the scene, like their competitors. What's a guy named Scott Rose? Is like, I think his name is some
Zach
guy.
Zach Rose, I think.
Zach Rose, sorry. There's a guy named Vinny something, like the, who's like, who's just like, it's like, this stuff is, it's really unbelievable. Like you watch it over and over again, you're like, this is fucking unbelievable, but yet,
I think the other dude's name was like Parking Lot Pete, but he was like
Parking Lot Pete. Yeah.
He's like some out of Breaking Bad, but he had like really a New Jack Swing R&B group.
He did.
Yeah, they showed his video, and I looked him up on Discogs. He had his record on there. So funny.
I mean, it was just to tell the listeners, Parking Lot Pete was a guy who had an MRI trailer behind a strip club in Florida. So at a certain point, like the people caught on enough to the point where like you at least had to have an MRI, like demonstrating that you had need for this pain medicine. And so they just built that into like the sort of charade of this whole thing. And Parking Lot Pete had his MRI service at a trailer behind a strip club there in Florida. People would just line up and go through, and you know, and miraculously every single person who went through there had a need for pain meds. It's really quite remarkable.
On this note, I did want to point out that if you have watched this film I do recommend going to AmericanPainFilm.com/individuals. And it is a page set up sort of like a crime wall, like or the investigation wall, like you see in a police drama, or if you're actually involved in law enforcement, you've probably seen one in real life, not just on a TV show, but it's like one of those visual tools used by law enforcement agencies to organize and analyze information related to a criminal investigation or enterprise. So like when you see all the sort of photos of the Sopranos on a wall, you know.
Yeah,
one of those for every of the characters, all the kind of players in this world of American Pain. So I definitely go do some secondary reading on those folks and get a little bit more information about how they operated together and what pieces of the puzzle they provided and what's happened to them since. Good stuff.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, with that, let's go into our interview with Darren. It's a good conversation. He's a nice guy, cool dude, works on a lot of different stuff. He's the co-founder of a company called Muck Media. It's a production company. He's worked on a series called Trafficked with Mariana Van Zeller, which is a documentary series about global black markets and trafficking networks. And he's also one of the two people primarily behind the documentary Science Fair, which I've heard quite a lot about. I haven't seen it yet, though. And that's a documentary about 9 high school students from around the globe competing at an international science fair. And I read that film is being adapted into a narrative feature by Elizabeth Banks. So that's pretty exciting.
That sounds great.
So, yeah, it does. So without further ado, here's our interview with Darren Foster, director of American Pain.
Can you tell me just like what your experiences with this, just a little bit that I've looked around online? I try not to like overly research people, like to just have conversations with them, but from what I could tell, it's a subject that you're pretty have been up on for a long time. So like the not the George brothers specifically necessarily, but the opioid crisis at large. So what's your background in that?
Yeah, sure. So I'm originally a journalist. I got into journalism thinking I was going to be a writer and write for magazines. But this was in the mid to late 2000s when magazines were struggling. So it was not a great time to get into the magazine industry. But my partner, and who is now my wife at the time, was very much into documentaries. And both being journalists, we decided to sort of marry our skills together. And some of the earliest work we started doing were TV investigations, long form sort of investigations for television. And one of the early stories we jumped on were these pain clinics in South Florida. And so this was in like 2008, 2009 that we started catching wind of them and ultimately went down there to start reporting on them in real time as it was happening. Of course, this was very early in the opioid epidemic and we had no perspective on exactly what was happening. But, you know, years later, I would continue to report on the opioid crisis as it evolved from pills to heroin and eventually to fentanyl, which is what we're experiencing today with these, you know, incredible overdose rates that we're seeing across the country. And while I was reporting on all this, I kept on going back to this incident in Florida where we were reporting on these pain clinics. And I went to this one clinic that had, you know, a reputation above all the others for being the sort of most prolific dispenser of oxycodone. And the clinic was called American Pain. And so in 2009, I went down there to film American Pain and I, you know, stood outside the clinic, got my camera out. I took one shot and the next thing I knew, I was surrounded by these really big dudes. And so they chased my wife and I down I-95. And eventually the police came and broke us up. But I took down the license plate of one of the vehicles and it traced back to Chris George. And that was the first time that I heard the name Chris George. And it turned out he had an identical twin brother named Jeff George. And about 9 or 10 months after we initially, you know, took that shot of the pain clinic, they were the targets of the largest prescription drug trafficking case in U.S. history. And so, you know, I kind of kept tabs on that case for a while. And then as the opioid crisis started to blossom into what it's become, blossom's too pretty of a word, I think, for what's happened, but it, you know, evolved into what it's become. I kept on coming back to them because to me, you know, the story of the George brothers is the story just how corrupt and greedy the pharmaceutical industry had become, that they would partner with people like the George brothers. And the George brothers were by no means an anomaly in this case. They were pioneers in many ways, but there were a lot of other sort of, you know, characters down there in South Florida who were doing the exact same thing, copying what they were doing, and, you know, basically pushing millions and millions and millions of pills onto the street and eventually seeding what we now know as the opioid epidemic.
Do you have a sense of when people come to this film, how much they understand or know about how this problem has been developing? Do they primarily think of it as like a street level thing? Do they think of it, they sort of have, you know, enough vocabulary around it to understand that they're like, are the Sacklers in Purdue? Are they people that are coming to this pretty fresh on the idea that pain clinics even existed? Or what's been your experience with that?
Yeah, it's a great question, because initially when I started pitching this as a documentary idea, there was a lot of educating of the people that I was pitching to about what was going on. And I think even when we did our original stories, people had a really hard time wrapping their head around the idea that doctors were somehow complicit, or pharmaceutical companies and sales reps were somehow complicit in the opioid crisis. And, you know, obviously now in retrospect, and with all the evidence that's come out, it's, you know, it's pretty well documented the role that these companies have had. But I thought that the missing chapter in a lot of the stories that had been told about the opioid crisis was just how the mechanics of it all worked, how, you know, a prescription drug, you know, went from being something that doctors prescribed in a doctor's office to people in pain to becoming the most prevalent street drug in America. You know, what we saw going on in Florida and what these guys will tell you in the film is that people that were traditionally, you know, dealing in heroin and cocaine, they knew what the score was back in the mid-2000s, late 2000s. They knew that the money to be made was not in those drugs. It was actually in prescription pills. And so that's why all these, you know, pain clinics started, you know, popping up all over Florida, hundreds of them. And a lot of them, you know, most of them were started by, you know, characters who had been involved in traditional street drugs. You know, the George brothers got their start, you know, distributing steroids. You know, Pill Mulvaney, who was in the documentary, you know, had been trafficking in heroin. Zach Rose had been dealing cocaine. But, you know, in the mid to late 2000s, the real money was in pills, because you could buy a pill at a clinic for $2-3 and flip it on the streets for 10 times that amount. And those kind of profit margins you wouldn't get in any other drug at the time.
Yeah, I'd agree definitely that this fills this gap. Talk about sort of the operational level, like how this actually happens. I've read, you know, I'm very, very interested in this subject for a variety of reasons. And, you know, I've read like Dreamland, I've read Painkiller, or, you know, books about the sort of Purdue side of things, with this level in the middle that talks about how things actually work. It doesn't seem to have been told. And it was really interesting to see it from the perspective of the people who are actually, you know, involved in some way. So it's a great addition to that canon of educating people about how this all came to be.
Yeah, those are all incredible books. I've read them all and respect all those authors so much. And I think you're right. You know, like, the opioid crisis is such a massive public health crisis that it needs like so much, you know, so many people to sort of be looking at it. And, you know, the books you mentioned are incredible. And, you know, like I said, I think what, you know, American Pain, the film does, is looks at this, you know, where the rubber hits the road. It's like, you could talk about what goes on in the corporate boardrooms. That's an important element. You could talk about, you know, the history of the crisis. But I think like the real key to sort of understanding like how a prescription drug became a drug of such widespread abuse, you really need to understand from the people who understood it before everybody else, which was this, like, you know, sort of like random group of criminals and outlaws down in Florida.
Yeah, I do want to ask a couple questions about, like, specifically the filmmaking, but what you just said reminded me of something I wanted to talk to you about, which is, I don't remember if it's in the film or not. I know that Chris George, towards the end of the film, he seems pretty unrepentant. He basically, you know, he's out of jail and he basically says, like, look, this is a system that we took. I mean, he's basically saying we took advantage of the system as it was. We didn't do anything wrong. The doctors were the ones prescribed it. We were running the business and sort of taking advantage of this opportunity that was presented to us in the same way that other kinds of businesses do. Now, I don't remember if this is in the film or not, or I read it somewhere else, but I remember reading with Derek Nolan something very similar, which I thought was even put a finer point on it, which is, he says, you know, the question is not why would guys like us do this? It's why was it possible for us to do this? And, like, obviously he's deflecting quite a bit and, you know, moving the responsibility off of himself and George's to systemic issues. But there is something there, and, you know, suggesting that the environment, you know, the system allowed or even, you know, encouraged in some ways them to do, be people to do these kinds of things. And I wonder if you have any thoughts about that.
Yeah, I mean, 100%. I mean, you know, when I approach Chris George and Jeff George and Derek Nolan, you know, to be part of this, you know, I told them, I just want you guys to tell me how it happened, you know, to just tell me how it happened. And every, you know, single person that was involved in this, you know, sort of had an idea of what they were doing was probably morally or ethically wrong. But by the law, you know, there was nothing that they could point to that says like, hey, we're really going to get in trouble for this. And there was just a situation in Florida where it was like, hey, just look the other way, or, you know, don't, you know, talk too much about this. We're just going to push these pills out and have these doctors write the scripts. I mean, everybody in the whole, you know, the whole line from the patient that went in there and pretended to be in pain and brought in an MRI that showed they were in pain to the doctor who looked at that MRI and was like, oh yeah, now you need 240, 30 milligram oxycodone, to the sales reps who were like, oh, this is just a doctor's office we're selling these pills to. Everybody just sort of had the assurances that they needed to cover their own ass. And then, you know, that's what allowed all this to happen. But obviously, you know, something like that, when people are dying, we'll catch up with you eventually. But I do give credit to Chris George and Jeff George and Derek Nolan, because they actually sort of told their story. Mm-hmm. We're still waiting to hear the story of these pharmaceutical companies, you know, who have spent millions and millions and millions of dollars to sort of protect, you know, what their role in this was. You know, while Chris George and Jeff George and Derek Nolan went to jail for many, many years for what they did, there's not one pharmaceutical executive who's, you know, gotten in any real criminal trouble for their role in this. I mean, save one from Incest Therapeutic, but the rest have pretty much gotten off with a slap on the wrist and, you know, paying some company fines.
In that process of trying to explain to people who would finance it or help make it happen, was there ever sort of a time where you felt like you were being veered towards making this sort of like a true crime type thing? Because I've actually seen it referred to that way a few times. It isn't that at all. It's very different than those sorts of movies. I think that that's the way that people will pitch it to each other, even when they recommend it, because it's easy shorthand for the kind of movie that you might like if you latch on to certain aspects of this.
Yeah, I've seen it called the true crime piece too. I was never, you know, actually, you know, one of the great things about Barnum with CNN Films, you know, at the time, was that they would discourage anything, you know, like that. They wanted this very sort of like character driven, you know, anatomy of a crime sort of story that was, you know, both nuanced and really detailed and thoroughly reported. So they kept on encouraging me to do more and more reporting and to really, you know, bring the details of the story to light. And one of, you know, the sort of, you know, I guess, benefits of being stuck in a pandemic is, you know, not being able to shoot anything for a few months, is that I spent so much time with the documents. Me and my editor, Rob Nassa, we just like pored over these documents and we were looking for these details in there that really helped bring the story to life. And we started editing with these documents. And then we realized, you know, this story is so, you know, unbelievable. You know, like it's like people would not believe the story if you told them. And so, but showing these documents and getting the wiretaps in there sort of lent an authenticity to this story. So as unbelievable and you can't believe this is actually true as this story is, you know, we had all this documentation that we sort of employed in the visual style of the film to sort of help authenticate what was happening. So if it seemed too outrageous, trust us, it's true. This is all really happened. Yeah.
Where do you get those documents? I mean, I'm sure they're publicly available, but I'm not even sure what that means to someone who's looking for them. Someone who has done research and reporting on this would know, but the average person probably wouldn't know where you'd turn that stuff up.
Yeah, a lot of it came from the court exhibits in the case. And then a lot of it came from freedom of information requests, which, you know, like I said, it took like, you know, years to sort of actually yield anything. But that's where the, you know, the real juicy stuff is, the undercover video, the wiretaps and stuff like that. And that allowed, even though, you know, this case is, you know, more than a decade old, this story happened over 10 years ago, it makes it feel present day because you're hearing people talk, you know, contemporaneously about what it's happening, you know, referencing, you know, things in real time as they're unfolding. And so, you know, the day that, you know, I got those wiretaps, it was like Christmas morning. It was, you know, it took years to get them, but when I got them, I was like, holy shit, this is great.
Yeah. Was that during COVID?
Yeah, it was during COVID. Yeah. Yeah. So like, you know, it definitely slowed down the timeline that we were thinking for the film, but it gave me way more time to there's just tens and tens of thousands of documents. And then I listened to every single phone call. And I think there was like 17,000 calls over, you know, the period.
Wow.
That we're talking. And I listened to every single one of those calls. So it took a long time.
Wow. Probably heard a lot of dumb shit, I have to say.
Well, you know, I think if you listen to any of our phone calls, you'd hear a lot of dumb shit.
That's true.
But, you
know, very diplomatic. Did you say also that the COVID sort of enabled you to come up with this, like, maybe an unusual way to talk to interview folks, like to interview some of the subjects?
Yeah, well, you know, because we couldn't, you know, I was getting into the Bureau of Prisons to film in federal prison is notoriously difficult, if not, you know, impossible sometimes. So I knew it was a long shot that we'd get cameras in there anyway. But when COVID happened, it was just impossible. There was no way they were going to let us in, the film crew, and to interview anybody. And so, you know, just to sort of start mapping out the story and do sort of a radio cut, I started doing prison phone calls. And, you know, there was something about those calls that I thought I was getting really good stuff with. And we laid that in thinking it was going to be temporary. And it actually wound up being like really great, even though the quality isn't, you know, the best. It sort of just matched with the wiretaps and all that. And it just kind of gave everything a bit of a gritty texture. I felt like it really worked with the film anyway. And then, you know, you sort of had this disembodied voice talking to you from, you know, this crackly phone line describing what's going on. And yeah, I don't know. It just lent it, like, the film a certain texture that I really liked. And so when then Chris finally got out of jail, I was there to film getting out of jail. And I was like, we could sit down and do, you know, repeat everything, or we could just keep what we have and I could ask some additional questions, which is what we wound up doing. And so, yeah.
Why did they want to talk to you? You mentioned that there was, you know, you kind of kudos on them for wanting to tell their story while the farming companies haven't.
I think one of it is because, you know, I've been on their case since like 2009. And so
well, that could have gone another way though, right?
Yeah, it could have gone another way. But I think, you know, I was very sort of upfront with them and transparent with them about what I wanted to do. I told them I would let them tell the story in their own words, which I did. And I'd let them sort of, like, you know, reflect on it after 10 years in prison, after it's all said and done. How do you feel about this? I gave Chris the last word. And so I think that was a big part of it. And I think, you know, and as you mentioned before, you know, Chris particularly and his brother Jeff, like they both feel like, while they said they feel bad that people had died because of, you know, these drugs, they felt like they were, you know, sort of practicing within the law at the time, or at least the letter of the law. So, you know, he wanted to sort of explain himself on that level. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, you know, that is the reason why, you know, they chose to tell this story, because I think they feel like it's just not as black and white as everybody assumes it was.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Has there been any memorable feedback from, like, any individuals who've seen the movie that reached out or that you've seen somewhere that said anything about it that was compelling to you?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen, I think, you know, like a lot of people are just shocked, to be honest. Like, I think, you know, the people had no idea that there was this level of sort of the brevity around a prescription drug. You know, I always say this is like the greatest, you know, racket to hit South Florida since the since the cocaine cowboys of the 1980s. And, you know, I think that's very true, just because, you know, in the 80s it was cocaine, but in the mid 2000s, late 2000s, it was these oxycodone pills with the Roxys, whatever we call them. And, you know, I, in my course of, you know, reporting on this, you know, I saw those pills popping up, you know, from as far north as Boston and Maine, all the way down to Florida and Kentucky in between. So I think just like the fact that, you know, people were able to describe these days, and I think, you know, the family from Kentucky who's in the film, you know, describe it almost as like, you know, the days of milk and honey, you know, like when you could just get drugs so easily, and they were making, you know, tons of money, you know, in a place where jobs were hard to come by at the time. And so I think just like the candidness of some of those characters is like what people have most responded to.
So I know that you are, you know, you cover a lot of different subjects in the films that you make. Is there more to this story that you're interested in making somewhere down the road too?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, I spent so much of my, you know, career and reporting career anyway, like about the, you know, reporting on the opioid crisis. And I feel like it's been so well documented now. You know, you mentioned a lot of the great books that have been written about it. And, you know, I don't know if there's anything left in this space for me to do, but I still feel like, you know, the whole story hasn't been told. And, you know, I always have my sort of eye out for something new, you know, in the story that hasn't been told. And I have, you know, lots of sources, obviously, from over the years who sort of clue me into what's happening. But yeah, it's pretty bleak out there with the whole fentanyl of it all. And so I'm not sure if I'm ready to do another one just yet.
Right. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed the movie, got a lot out of it. I've been recommending it to folks and really good to talk to you about it.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And yeah, thank you. This was fun.
All right. So that was my interview with Darren Foster, director of American Pain. What'd you think? Do you think it was awesome?
I thought it was great. And I just think it's really cool that guy's...
Thanks, buddy.
I don't know. I enjoyed it. And I just wanted to say, I think it's really cool that guy's doing good and important work. You know what I mean? Immersing yourself in that world and bringing this horrible situation to light. And like you said, with the Trafficked series, it's like this is not like he's not a guy that's just out there doing small potato stuff. Like he's doing the good work, you know, and that's really cool.
Definitely.
And he seems like a cool dude. And you know, and one thing that like I didn't find a spot to mention it before, but I just kept thinking about there's like this one detail in this film about Chris George specifically. I don't know how this applies to Jeff George, where he's just like avowed white supremacist.
Right.
And like it's just mentioned and you see it in a few details. You see he's got a big SS tattoo on one side. You should also mention these guys are like huge steroidy bodybuilder dudes. Like it's so ridiculous. So he's got a big SS tattoo on one side, a swastika tattoo on the other side. In his house they show he has this like mirror art, like two walls like facing each other of his room of like an SS mirror and a swastika mirror thing. And then you see a giant swastika skull flag in his garage. And beyond that, we don't get any real details about like what role that plays in his life or but I just like, it's just like, what in the fuck is going on? Like, I don't know. It just seems like it's worth mentioning that like this, if there's any, like, if you think these guys can't get creepier, like, you know.
Yeah. That is one of the criticisms of the film that I have seen. I didn't really hold this criticism myself, but in reading just a few pieces about the movie, I did see that people thought that was kind of dropped in at the end and then there was no comment. My sense of it, and I meant to ask Darren about this, but I didn't get around to it. All right, I forgot to be honest with you. I forgot. I'm going to be honest with you.
That's totally fair.
My sense is that this is like, it's another thing. Like, it's like, it's another thing about how fucking ridiculous and stupid these guys are. Like, he probably didn't take much action on it. Like, I don't think he, like, there, he, some of the doctors he hired were black. There were plenty of people around him that were not white. Didn't seem like it, like he led his life by anything. There was no compass at all. Just sort of like, maybe he thought that this shit looked cool or was like a cool association for him to have, or he fell in. I would have been interested to hear more about it, but my sense was that it, like, it was just, here's another detail about these idiots.
Yeah, no, that is true. I think it, in a way, it kind of, you see how it sort of ties in with like a lack of any kind of, depth of thinking around any of what this stuff actually means, like what you're aligning yourself with, what you're doing. It's just not looking beyond just like the aesthetic, or in the case of what they did with the pill mills, like this, you know, we're profiting from it. So what else is there to think about? It's like, well, I don't know, but it's really, and I, the last of the thing, probably the most damning thing, even more than being a tattooed white supremacist, they do show a montage of how Chris George was spending his money at one point, and they show him at a concert, and I'm pretty sure it was Kid Rock. And I think that was one.
What a
of
surprise.
The, yeah, it was, I was shocked. And
right.
And that's about as low as you can go.
He wasn't at a pavement show.
No, it wasn't a pavement show. Unless Pavement started putting a big fucking Confederate flag in their background on their most recent tour. I didn't catch that.
Right. He went to go see Outkast. Who would have thought? All right, man. Well, as always, love seeing you. Love talking to you. Love talking to you about movies. I'm excited to do more of these. I think the next one we're going to watch and we're going to talk about is the 3-part documentary series Love Has Won, The Cult of Mother God by Hannah Olsen.
Mm, yeah.
I did talk to Hannah Olsen. I talked to Hannah Olsen a couple years ago about a movie, a film that she did. Maybe we'll recirculate that conversation. It was called Baby God, I believe. Is that right?
Oh.
Yep. Called Baby God. Baby that was God. Also free. Or it was on Max, HBO at the time. And definitely recommend watching that too. At any rate, her current film, a three-part series, Love Has Won, The Cult of Mother God. And this is about a woman named Amy Carlson, also known as Mother God, who proclaimed herself as a spiritual savior and managed to build a following by sharing her beliefs through online manifestos and live streaming sessions. I had never heard of this story. Apparently, like, there's a lot of people who've been talking about it for years, because after I watched it, you can go back and see this very robust subreddit of people who have been parsing every detail of this for years and years.
Wow.
But it is a wild story. You and I have shared lots of screenshots and conversation about it. I'm really excited to talk to you about it in this format. And also, I believe we're going to have an opportunity to talk to Hannah as well. So excited about that.
It's unbelievable. I'm really, really looking forward to talking with you more about that one.
Well, until then, I hope you have a great rest of your day. And I will talk to you again soon, my friend. And anyone listening, hope you're doing great. I hope you have a great day. Fuck it. Have a great week. Have a great month. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Thanks, everybody.